Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome to the Future Projection Podcast, a Baseball America podcast featuring myself, Carlos Collazo, and Ben Badler. This is episode 21. We are in the new year, our first podcast in 2022. Ben, how's it going, man? And where have you been? Where have we been?
Yeah, where have we been? It's been a while since we recorded. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of people don't know this yet, but I actually got suspended from the Future Projection Podcast in November.
Yes, without pay.
I said some critical things about Rob Manfred and about the commissioner's office. So I got sent away for a while, and MLB started my re-education process. Met this really nice guy, Ken, who was there with me. But I'm back now. I'm here to spread the truth about Rob Manfred, the greatest commissioner in the history of all sports. Many people are saying that, and is now honorably trying to save America's pastime from baseball's greatest enemy, the baseball player. So I learned a lot during my time there. No, just
wonderfully put, Ben. Wonderfully put. I could not have said it better myself.
Kidding aside, I was out for about a month because in November I became a dad. My daughter.
Yes. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, my daughter was born, came up about a month before her due date. So she's tiny, but she's super adorable. Just being able to hold her, maybe not the first time, because that was just so chaotic and screaming and I was crying and there were all these doctors and nurses in the room. But I think the second time I got to hold her, it was just me and my wife, and just a really special feeling that I haven't felt anything like that before. So at the same time, wow, does it drain everything from your time, your energy, mm-hmm. your mental capacity? It's exhausting. I'm not sure if my brain is still operating at full speed right now, going on four or five hours maybe of sleep each night. So if any of my calls on breakout players or anything like that end up being wrong by the end of the year, that's
we'll just chalk it up to your fatherly duties now.
That's the reason why. But but yeah, I was just being a dad for about a month. Came back, finished the prospect handbook, and then it was the holidays. So now we're back.
We are. It is nice for you to finally get that out there, Ben. I obviously didn't want to spoil the announcement for you. Wanted you to kind of take the time yourself to share it with our listeners and all the Bay readers. I don't even know if you've put it on Twitter, if people just generally know, or if this is kind of going to be your announcement. But I think we had actually taken questions for this episode the day before your daughter was born. I think we were planning to record that morning, and then we woke up and we were getting ready to go, and you're like, I got to go to the hospital. I was like, okay. And then sure enough, new baby came into the world.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, no, I had prospect handbook calls with, you know, different folks from clubs lined up that day. I was like, we might have to reschedule. So, but somehow it all worked out on the baby side and the handbook side.
Yeah. I don't know if you're ever fully prepared for that. I obviously can't speak from any experience, and hopefully I won't have to for many, many years to come, because it sounds exhausting. But it does seem like the timing was chaotic for you. Cause I mean, we always talk about the prospect handbook season is insane. I feel like I have no time during prospect handbook. So I can't imagine trying to take care of another human being who's totally reliant on me, while also trying to, you know, write up a couple chapters in the prospect handbook and stay sane.
Yeah. Yeah. There's never like an ideal time on the Baseball America calendar to like take a month where you're pretty much out of it.
You basically need to try and sneak it in the 2 week period that is post handbook being sent and before we get started with January preview content and spring schedule stuff. There's a 2 week area you need to hit, but I guess it extends beyond 2 weeks regardless anyways. So
yeah, well, we got January 15th coming up with the international signing day too. So there's always something on the calendar, but yeah, I mean, I obviously stepped out in November and left you in charge of baseball while I was away. So I don't know, can you fill me in?
Poor decision on your part.
Can you fill me in? Like just,
we've had a lot going on,
big free agent signings,
a lot of transactions, yeah, big signings, big moves,
blockbuster deals. Like, how did the Rule 5 draft go? Like, what?
Yeah, it was JJ's favorite Rule 5 draft of all time. actually, it was kind of encouraging, or not encouraging, but just amazing to see JJ switch his passion for the Rule 5 draft to the minor league Rule 5 draft. And basically, he had to use that as his escape, and the amount of information and passion that he and Jeff Ponce, who we have not spoken about on this podcast because he came on board at Baseball America in between this episode and our previous episode, but those two, the amount of attention to detail they put into a minor league Rule 5 draft is truly just something that Baseball America, it's so Baseball America, it's such a minor niche little event on the baseball calendar that most people probably don't even know about. It's the diehard of the diehard event, and watching them put all that energy and information into that was really cool. But you had mentioned the international prospects, January 15th coming up. I wanted to just point out and alert to our listeners that you do have an update to our international prospect big board, the top 50 bonuses with their expected teams, with information on those players. Do you want to touch on that at all, Ben? I know, obviously, if you're a subscriber to Baseball America, you can get the entire article and all the information at your leisure, but just wanted to give you the opportunity to touch on the class or anything that you wanted to mention before we get into some of the topics of today's episode.
Yeah, we got, like you said, updating our board of the top 50 expected bonuses on, or players expected to top for those, expected to sign for those top 50 bonuses. You know, obviously these, you know, we've written about for going back a decade now, if not longer, that, you know, these players are, you know, reach, you know, commitments to sign with clubs way in advance of the signing day, which originally would have been July 2nd, 2021, but, gets pushed back 6 months to, January 15th this year. So a lot of these players have been, you know, committed to clubs going back two, if not 3 years in some cases. So, you know, look, I was going back and looking at videos of some of these guys who I saw back in like 2019. That's the last time that, you know, a lot of international scouts, from clubs that are not going to sign a player have seen a lot of these guys. So, you know, it's totally different than the draft process, which is why we just lined it up by the bonus amount. Not obviously, certainly don't believe that the amount of money you sign for is a perfect proxy for talent by any means. And because these kids can change so much in 3 months, 5 months, 8 months, let alone a year or multiple years. So very, very different than than the draft, even the 2020 draft, where we didn't really have much new information, you know, leading up to the, you know, the spring and the summer that year.
Yeah, the evaluation gap is still smaller in that case. Given that, is it at all easy or not easy, but do you have a gauge as to the strength of a class compared to a typical international signing class, or is it really just impossible to tell, given the amount of information that you don't have to work with these guys not getting out and being evaluated by teams and by scouts?
Yeah, it's harder to say, because there's so many guys who will be, you know, guys who will sign for 200,000, 400,000, where it's like, oh, like if everything, like, you know, wiped clean with a blank slate today, that guy might be, you know, a $1 million guy or a $2 million guy. So just the nature of how players are evaluated and the whole process works right now, where teams are focused probably more on 2024 players than they are on this year's class of guys right now, makes it really hard to say it at this point. back, you know, going back to like 2019, you at least had players signing on July 2nd, and then you could go through a whole process of seeing these guys play in Tricky League and Dominican Instructional League. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would go around to see almost every single team, either at their academy in the DR or watching them playing games against other clubs at other facilities. So I had a pretty good handle on guys by then. But for the pre-signing process right now, it's just much more, it's just more difficult to mm-hmm. get a strong grasp on that right now.
Yeah, that'll make sense. But definitely check out Ben's board if you have not at this point. It's up on the site right now. Another international topic I wanted to touch on at least briefly and see what your thoughts were. But I believe in late November, I think it was like November 27th, the Rays and Wander Franco agreed to an 11-year extension. It set the organization's record for the biggest contract ever given out by Tampa, topping Evan Longoria's $100 million deal. It is an 11-year, $182 million extension. We've seen teams in recent years, it seems like, be more aggressive in trying to extend some of their young talents before they reach free agency, pay them out of some of their arbitration years and just extend the team control on them. I'm just curious about what you think about this signing specifically, how this changes, maybe how you view Wander Franco and his value to the club, whether or not you think these are good moves for teams, whether or not you think they're good moves for players. Obviously, one of the contracts that gets brought up quite a bit that you could maybe tie into this conversation is Ronald Acuna's deal, which was an 8-year, $100 million contract that he signed with the Braves. And I think pretty immediately that contract was criticized as being extremely team friendly. But at the same time, I think we've talked about it, at least within the BA Slack. I don't know if I've publicly talked about this on the podcast, but for the individual, I can see it being very difficult to turn down a deal like that. I mean, Ronald Acuna was not a big bonus international signing by any means. He had not gotten his first big payday, and you never really know what's going to happen in the future. Even if you're one of the best young players in the world, you could get injured. Something could happen off the field. And $100 million is nothing to laugh at by any means. You're setting yourself up and your children up and your grandchildren up for years and years and years. So just wanted to throw this out, Ben, and see what you thought about the Wander Franco contract and teams trying to aggressively lock up younger players, if you think we'll continue to kind of see this happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great deal for the Rays. I mean, Wander was our number one prospect in baseball, I believe two years in a row. And yep. Everything, you know, you can see it in his major league debut. Everything points to him being a star, you know, potential superstar type player. I mean, I think he's going to be, you know, it's not like, you know, Vlad Jr. power or the, you know, just the raw tools that you see from like a Fernando Tatis Jr. or Ronald Acuna. But this is a really special hitter who I think is going to be in, you know, MVP conversations pretty consistently over the course of his career. And I believe he's still, what, 20, 21 years old now. So
I think he'll be in his age 21 season for the 2022 year. Yeah, he was in his age 20 season last year.
So he's, you know, you're securing as Tampa pretty much all of his prime years. You know, obviously the Rays are not a team that's going out and signing big free agents, but you're they're putting out some money. So they're obviously, I guess you'd say there is some risk, but at the same time, you know, I feel like Wander Franco is about as safe as a bet as it's going to get, just given his skill set and what he's already shown at a young age. At the same time, I mean, Wander Franco did not sign for a small bonus by any means. And, you know, he comes from a baseball family, and, you know, it's not like he's struggling by any means, but he's securing, like you said, a contract for close to $200 million. So I get why he did it too. I think it makes sense for him. I think what's, you know, sometimes we think about it as, you know, team friendly, or is it player friendly? And I think what happens a lot of times in when these deals actually get done is whether a deal is agent friendly, because that's a major, the agent is a major decision maker and an influencer in whether a, you know, a player is going to sign the contract. Cause I think a lot of teams are trying to extend their younger players, but the, you know, the agents who are, you know, who are larger agencies, you know, you don't see a lot of Boris Corporation clients taking these big extensions.
Because there's a reason why Juan Soto's free agency has been kind of talked about for years now, as everyone kind of is expecting him to get to free agency. No one ever thought he was going to sign one of these deals.
Right. So if, you know, if you're an agent and you have this, you know, a wide range of players in your agency, and you have a lot of different sources of revenue coming in, you can take the risk that, you know, you have a young player who you're, you don't really make money on these guys as an agent until they hit salary arbitration. And then really once they hit free agency, but if you're, you know, if you're representing an international player or say even a high school player in the United States, you might be representing them from the time they're, you know, or in the, you know, a player from the high school side, you know, advising them from the time they're 16 years old.
Yeah. Don't ruin anyone's eligibility in here, Ben. Come on.
Yeah. So it's a long process between, you know, 16, 17, even if you're, you know, getting them into your, as a client when they're 18 years old, it's a long road to get to just a salary arbitration or free agency by the time they're, you know, 28, 29, or sometimes 30 years old. And along the way, if some other agent comes in and takes your client away from you, you're just out of luck, man. Like you don't, you don't get paid. You don't get a commission on their contract at all. But if your client, you know, if you're a smaller agency, you're dependent on fewer players. If you have a client who signs this, a $50 million extension while you're his agent, before he gets to free agency, before he gets to salary arbitration, you're able to lock that commission in for yourself. So it's one of these principal agent problems to a certain extent where, I think it's a good deal for Wander Franco to take. So I don't want that to get misconstrued, but I think that the who a player's agent is and the circumstances there are often a driving factor in whether the deal actually gets done, just as much as whether it's, you know, team friendly or player friendly.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. This deal, it's 11 years. It takes Wander through his age 32 season in 2033. I believe there is a buyout. And he'll be an unrestricted free agent at the latest in 2034, which would be his age 33 season. So there's a chance. I mean, it's an 11-year contract. So you think, okay, this is his one big payday. But he's so young when he got to the major leagues and established himself, and when he got this extension, that he's setting himself up for another pretty solid contract in his early 30s if he continues to be the player that we all expect him to be. Are there any other players that you would feel confident in extending if you're running a team, Ben, or any player types that you feel more confident in general? And would you be as aggressive in trying to pursue some of these deals with pitchers, let's say, just given the attrition rate of those guys? Or just how would you view it from the team aspect if you're running a club?
Yeah, it's something where it's interesting because, you know, Franco doesn't have he has major league experience, obviously, and we saw what he did. I mean, he's, you know, close to the rookie of the year, even though
place finish in the rookie of the year in just 70 games. I think I don't know if we talked about this on the podcast either. I would have voted for Wander, just prorating what he did. I don't know if you can hold his ABs and his innings against him, because, I mean, honestly, he could have been promoted very early in the season, and I think he would have held his own. But that's just speculation. But given what he did in the time that he had available, I thought he was probably the best rookie in baseball.
Yeah, I mean, I think you go back and you look at a contract, you know, even like Evan Longoria's with the Rays, or which obviously worked out, you know, tremendously for Tampa, or some other deals like, you know, Scott Kingery with the Phillies, or Jonathan Singleton, some of these contracts that did not work out for the clubs, you know, I guess give it a little more time in Kingery's case, but you know, I think teams will or probably should be more aggressive in trying to, you know, see if they can secure contract extensions with players who have yet to make their major league debut, or even have very, very little time at the big league level. Obviously, you know, we have more confidence, even more confidence. I guess I was always had a lot of confidence in Wander even before the 2021 season. But, you know, when you see him perform the way he did at the major league level, certainly you're going to have more confidence in how it's going to translate at that level. But I think we have a lot of information now on these players. We know they're extremely, especially the top 25, 50 type prospects in baseball. We know those guys are extremely valuable. The success rate on those guys, especially a top 25 type of position prospect, the returns on those players have typically been pretty outstanding, with obviously still some misses in there. But I do think teams, I wonder if we'll see it become happening more often, because I think it should happen, where teams will try to be more aggressive in securing these extensions for players before they get to the big leagues. Obviously, maybe not at the level of a Wander Franco type of money, but I think there are players who, you know, would take, you know, 40, 50 million type dollar extensions and give up their free agency years too, in exchange for, you know, what would, you know, generally be, I think, looked at as a team friendly mm-hmm. contract. If, you know, even if the player turns into an average everyday type of big leaguer.
Yeah. I'm curious how the frequency of these type of deals will change in whatever the new CBA system we're working with. Obviously, we don't know what that's going to be yet, but I would imagine that the union is pushing pretty hard to get younger players paid earlier in their careers. Obviously, younger players are more valuable than ever, just given the young players in the league, given how some of these stars have come in and performed. And obviously teams want to get the most out of those players while they're on these cheap deals. So I'm really curious to see how that kind of element of this will impact the number of these deals we see, and whether or not players will be more or less incentivized to take these.
Why it's always surprised me why the union has not pushed harder to raise the minimum salary from, you know, $500,000 or so. I mean, I think that's part of why these guys are taking some of these deals, is because those first 3+ years in the big leagues, it's not poverty wages or anything like that, but it's, you know, the amount of money you can make if you're willing to give up free agent years to sign in a, you know, what generally be called, I think, a team friendly extension is so alluring, because the disparity between that and the league minimum salary is just so great.
Mm-hmm. Any other big deals that you want to mention before we get into some prospect handbook talk, Ben? There was a lot of stuff that happened prior to the lockout happening, but it was obviously a bit ago. So if you don't have anything, we can jump into another topic that I wanted to touch on. Matt Eddy wrote about recently on the site, but I'll just give you a chance to mention anything else if you want to.
I mean, like the minor league rule 5 draft, or
yeah, or any deals, or maybe you can talk more about Ken. I don't know, whatever you have on your mind.
No, I mean, it's cool. I like seeing Texas get aggressive. I don't mm-hmm. know. Curious to see how that's all shakes out, but it's fun to see teams even at the bottom spending money to just to get more aggressive.
I guess one other one I want to ask you about was the Byron Buxton deal. It's not the same as Wander Franco. Obviously, Buxton has been in the league for a while, but the deal itself and how reliant it is on incentives and playing time, I thought made sense, a ton of sense for both sides. I was excited to see a quote unquote small market organization like Minnesota keep a fan favorite and franchise player in Minnesota. It seemed like Byron definitely wanted to make that happen. It seemed like a very fair deal just based on how it was organized. And if Buxton stays healthy, you have to be thrilled with what you're getting from him for that dollar amount. I think even if he hits all those incentives, you'd still feel pretty good given that he was really the best player in baseball last year when he was healthy. So that was a fun one to see from my perspective. You have any thoughts on the Buxton Twins deal?
Yeah. I mean, you keep saying if he stays healthy, right? Like that's everything with him. He's played over 100 games like once in his career, and he's in his late 20s now. Players typically don't get healthier in their 30s. So it's, I mean, I love Byron Buxton. I've been a huge Byron Buxton believer for a long time, but man, is it just frustrating when he just can't stay on the field. So, I mean, I think it's a really good deal for him. And he's obviously just one of those players where it's like, I wish he could just stay healthy. Like, you know, like think back to like Grady Sizemore, somebody like that. Like there's just these guys where, I mean, there is a skill to health and durability, even for position players. And it just really, would scare me, but at the same time, I mean, I get it. Like when he's on the field, especially last year, he's one of the elite players in the game.
Yep, no doubt. We'll see what happens with Buxton. Wanted to talk a little bit about the next wave of catching that we will hopefully be seeing in the big leagues. Recently, and we've talked about this for a while, how good the catching depth is on the top 100 throughout last year. And after going through the prospect handbook season, Matt Eddy did a story on how there are now 7 catchers who rank as number one prospects in their organizations for this year. That is a new high watermark for the Baseball America era. We've done this for 40 years, and that topped the previous high, which I believe was 5. But I'll link Matt Eddy's full story in the show notes so you guys can check out the exact details on that. But obviously, with Adley Rutschman being at the top of this list and a number of impressive players, including Gabriel Moreno, Francisco Alvarez, Diego Cartaya, Corey Lee, Cabert Ruiz, and Tyler Soderstrom, we have an extremely impressive group of catchers, and that's not even touching on others who aren't number one players in their organization, guys like Shea Langeliers, Henry Davis, Joey Bart, and more. Just it feels like it keeps going on and on and on. Obviously, the catching talent at the major league level at this point is pretty depressing. And maybe that's just based on how catchers have been valued with pitch framing becoming so important that hitting maybe takes a backseat. And maybe as the robo umps come in, we'll just get a higher bar for the offensive game at the position. But either way, the talent is at a very high level right now. And I guess over the next decade or so, we maybe should see another wave of really impressive catchers kind of following up a group with Buster Posey and Yadier Molina and some others who headed a catching era that is pretty much over now. But Ben, what do you think about the state of catching? I guess not in Major League Baseball, but in prospects who we should see very soon in Major League Baseball.
Yeah, I think it's phenomenal right now. I mean, like you said, Adley, obviously, I think you make a case for him to be the number one overall prospect in baseball. You mentioned, you know, Francisco Alvarez and Gabriel Moreno. You know, both of them certainly could be top 10. I'll even stretch it to top 20 prospects just to, you know, put a wider band around it. So I think there's about a dozen or so guys. You know, you mentioned a bunch of them, like MJ Melendez, Luis Campusano, Joey Bard. I think you mentioned Corey Lee. Like, there's about a dozen guys who I could see being in our top 100. I think there'll be at least 10 catchers who will be in our top 100. And the thing about all those guys too, probably with the exception of Tyler Soderstrom, where there's some more questions about his defense, although it seems like it's going in the right direction. It might just be a matter of like his bat is so good. we just need to get him in the lineup. Yeah. And he's in the big leagues by, like, you know, 20, 21 years old. So that could be part of it in his case, but otherwise pretty much all these guys are going to stick behind the plate too. It's not like catchers in name only, like Adley and Gabriel Moreno and, you know, Alvarez obviously had some work, I think, work to do early on in his career on blocking and receiving, but like these other guys are going to stick behind the plate and have a chance to deliver some pretty good offensive impact too. So it's a pretty, like you said, pretty striking disparity between the level of, or the caliber of catching that we're seeing and the offensive performances that we're seeing from catchers at the major league level right now compared to what we hopefully will be seeing, you know, 5 years down the road when these guys get to the big leagues or are really making an impact in the big leagues.
Obviously there are a lot of guys who are going to be in the top 100 that maybe all of our listeners are pretty familiar with, but do you have any interesting picks who maybe won't be on the top 100, at least to start the year, that you're fascinated by? I know there's one in particular that you seem very high on from the 2021 draft class, but are there any guys that you just want to point out or highlight here that maybe aren't the elite top tier catching prospects now, but you think are worth keeping an eye on or just following closely as we kind of get into the season?
Yeah, I love Harry Ford, Mariners first round pick this year. I mean, I wouldn't call him like a sleeper that. Obviously he was a, you know, pretty prominent first round pick coming out of high school from Georgia, came out, had a really nice pro debut in Arizona.
And Ben, I think that for these questions, you must just like have a spreadsheet of height and you basically eliminate anyone who's over 6'1" from your answers. You just do not go for the tall guys. Anyone who's short, you're in on.
Well, it just continues to be a trend, I guess.
I love it. That is true. That is true.
but with Ford, it's, I mean, he's such an unusual catching prospect, right? Because you could throw him out at third base. You could put him at second base. You could run him out in center field, at least for now.
Yeah, he's such a freak athlete.
And feel good about it. Yeah, he's athletic. He can run. He's explosive. So all the athletic indicators that you look for there, just as far as the raw athleticism, but I think he's a pretty polished hitter too, like a pretty polished baseball player. I think he's got a good sense of the strike zone. I really like his swing. It's compact. It makes a lot of contact. There's some explosion in that swing too. And I think there's some power there too, certainly in the future. So I think he's a guy who's gonna, you know, get on base at a high clip, make a lot of contact and has a chance to be, you know, 2025 type home run hitter and maybe stay behind the plate. Again, he's just such an unusual guy where he could, like, not quite like Will Myers, or like he's a different athlete than Will Myers was as a catcher, but somebody where, yeah, maybe it's third base, maybe it's right field, maybe it's center field.
I mean, he legitimately has a chance to play center field if they wanted to run him out there. I think he could handle himself pretty well.
Yeah. So it's, you know, he's not like a typical center field, maybe body type right now. Like, I don't know how that's run tool is going to age, especially if they keep him catching. So maybe that backs up, but like, I mean, certainly put him on a corner out, like put him in right field. I think he'd be a chance to be a plus defender out there just with the tool. So there's a lot of things to like about him athletically and as just as far as, you know, the flexibility of where he could fit on the field. But again, I always love guys who are just pure hitters who make a lot of contact, who control the strike zone, get on base, and can drive the ball. And he has all of that too. So he's one guy I could see who probably won't be, I would think, in our top 100 yet, but I think by the time, you know, we're having this conversation next year, I would bet on him making that jump in there.
Yeah. A guy I have is a little bit different from Ford's profile, similar questions about whether or not he's going to stay behind the plate, but I think for probably worse reasons than Harry Ford. And my guy is Austin Wells, who's the number 5 prospect in the Yankee system. unlike, I think you mentioned it, most of those top tier catching prospects that we mentioned, you feel pretty good about them sticking behind the plate. That's definitely not the case with Wells. I mean, he's still catching now. He spent all his time in the field at catcher in 2021. But the draw for me with Wells is just his bat. I mean, he is a guy who has such a lengthy track record of performing offensively. Going back to high school, he didn't catch a lot in high school because he had an arm injury. I think he was Under Armour All-American, actually. He was supposed to catch in the game, but didn't because he had an arm injury. But the bat has always been good. He's hit for power. He's had plus raw power, hit for a high average. He was a draft-eligible sophomore at Arizona who produced in both years in college at a very high level for average, for on-base percentage, for power, and was drafted in the first round by the Yankees. I think the Yankees actually drafted him out of high school and then again out of college. And in his pro career so far, he's continued to just hit well, very high average. I like how he controls the zone. I like the swing. I like the power potential. And for me, if he can just, the arm has some real questions. And I think just reading some of Josh's reporting and his scouting report on Wells this offseason as well, it hasn't trended in the right direction. So maybe he's a guy that has to move. And if so, maybe this is kind of cheating for this conversation on catchers, but if he does manage to stick back there, I have a lot of confidence in him bringing some value as an offensive contributor, as a left-handed bat with plate discipline, with power, and I think ability to hit for good average as well. So he's one that I'll point out. Ben, do you have any other ones you want to go to?
Yeah. I mean, one other guy I would say from who was with, was also in Arizona this past summer was Jefferson Kiro with the Brewers. Brewers seem to keep popping these interesting guys out of Venezuela between him and Hedbert Perez and Jackson Churio and probably some interesting guys. It sounds like coming on the 15th too for this year's class. So Kiro, I mean, I think Hedbert Perez is more famous right now, but it was pretty close as far as ranking them in the Brewer system this year. It was, they were right next to each other. You could flip a coin, I think, either way. I think Perez, obviously, more recognition. He was at the alternate training site in 2020 as a 17-year-old where he ever played and went out and had a good debut and got promoted to low A and by the end of the season as an 18-year-old. And I think Carroll might have joined him had he not gotten hurt at the end of the year. But every manager he's going to have is going to love him because he just has everything you're looking for defensively as far as, ability to receive, block, throw, plus arm, control the running game, does all the little things really well, especially for somebody who just turns 19 after the season and all the, everything as far as the, his ability to work with pitchers and leadership. He's just a very high energy, vocal type of leader that all of his, I think it's just going to really endear him to all of his managers and his teammates. But also he's a good hitter. I mean, it's not the bat speed that you see from Hedbert Perez or some other players. So I don't know how much power ultimately ends up being there in games. We'll see, but he had a nice debut in Arizona, hit over 300, on base over 400, slugged 500. Arizona helps the ball carry some, but he's another guy with a good eye for the strike zone, probably better than, or I would say definitely better than Hedbert right now, but makes a lot of contact, gets on base, and a guy who's a really strong bet to not just, I think, stick behind the plate, but really a really high caliber defender back there too. So I think he's he's already in the Brewers top 10 prospects, but I think he's a guy who, if he goes out next year, we could see him make maybe not this year, but or at some point, I think in the next couple of years, make a jump the way we saw, Keibert Ruiz make to become one of the better catching prospects in all of baseball.
Yeah, the guy I wanted to go to next is a player staying on the East Coast here, going to the Phillies, and a player who was near the back of the system a year ago, made a really impressive jump this season, and that's Logan Ohapi. He was drafted in the 23rd round out of high school, and just the progress he made with the bat, starting in high A this year in 2021, spent the bulk of his season there and hit really well, but advanced all the way to AAA as a 21-year-old. The offensive numbers weren't as impressive as he climbed the ladder, but I think it was just 19 games between AA and AAA, so not a huge sample. But I was really encouraged by the work that he was able to do with his swing path to kind of cut down the strikeouts. Previously, that was a big question mark for him. I think in low A in 2019, he struck out near a 30% rate. And in 2021, even as he climbed the ladder, that mark didn't get above 20% at any point during the year. And unlike Austin Wells, I think there's a lot to be excited about for Logan Ohapi defensively. I mean, we have plus defensive and throwing grades on him at the moment. He gets a lot of really impressive reviews for his makeup, his work ethic, just his dedication to the defensive game. It sounds like pitchers like throwing to him. So you feel pretty good about him sticking behind the plate. And I'm just really encouraged by his improvement and putting the bat on the ball this year. He's got some power. There are scouts who think he could be a guy who gets to 20-25 home runs. And if you're getting that kind of power output as a catcher and you feel pretty good about the defensive evaluations that you're getting, I'm pretty encouraged with that. The Phillies have had a couple position players that have made big jumps this year, and I think Logan Ohapi is one of the guys who, I don't know if he's getting enough attention, but really curious to see how he handles upper level pitching, maybe in a larger sample and over a full season. But just the work that he did with his swing over the last year, and I guess it was more than a year given the off time in the 2020 season or lack thereof, but he's encouraging to me just because I feel good about the defensive foundation. I like a lot about what we hear about with just makeup, work ethic. And if he is able to just put the bat on the ball a little bit more frequently, I think he's got the power, the raw power in the tank to provide some impact as well. So that's one that I'll kind of close with. Are there any others you wanted to mention, Ben, before we move on? There are a ton we could talk about.
Ohapi was always an interesting guy, like the summer after he signs. Mm-hmm. I remember talking to people around the Gulf Coast League about him and people bringing him up, which is kind of unusual for a 23rd round pick mm-hmm. out of high school. I mean, obviously, you know, signed for about $200,000, but you know, not like a $1.5 million guy in the at the end of the draft that you're
not getting. A Harry Ford caliber kind of prospect.
No, he's pretty under the radar, and you know, high school kid from New York, but right away seemed like there was something pretty interesting about him that the Phillies did a really nice job evaluating him, because yeah, like you said, can stick behind the plate, went out, had a really good pro debut that summer. So I think there is offensive ability there too to go with the defensive side. So I think, like you said, probably somebody who deserves some more attention and mm-hmm. and probably has always deserved some more attention than what he's got going back the last few years.
Yeah, absolutely. And kind of as we talk about these players, like guys who maybe you didn't really pay enough attention to, and as you kind of read up on what they're doing, the reports we're getting, and take a look at their performance, you start liking them more. Since the handbook process is complete now, and all of us have read through the bulk of the book, I'm sure a lot of people on staff have already read through the entire thing. You know, as we go through the editing process, it's always fun for me because it doesn't really feel like I'm working. I'm really just getting a better understanding of the talents around the game. But are there any prospects that you feel like throughout the process you really liked more and more, kind of as you kept reading about them and kept getting familiar with those players? Anyone who jumps out to you?
Yeah, well, one of mine was Aaron Ashby with the Brewers, left-handed pitcher who, you know, when everything got shut down in 2020, it was tough, right? Because he was at the alternate site, training site. He was all right there, and then went to instructional league, and he was like blowing guys away there. It sounded like his stuff had ticked up also, but at the same time, like he was 22 or maybe even 23 by the time Instruct started. going up against, you know, a lot of guys that are the same age as, like, you know, Hedbert Perez and Jefferson Kiro, like 18, 19 year olds. So how much stock do you put into that? And, you know, going at it in short stints, so only throwing a few innings at a time, how much does the, you know, the jump and stuff matter for that? Hard to say, but the, just going over the Brewers list this year, and obviously you have guys like Frelick and Sal Frelick, their first round pick last year, and Garrett Mitchell and Bryce Terang at the top of that system. But just looking at Ashby Moore, obviously went out and, you know, pitched in the big leagues this year, so a lot more people got to see him there. But just diving into him more, the more impressed I became with him. I think it's a chance for three plus or better pitches. Fastball's up to about 99 from the left side. His slider can be a real wipeout pitch when it's on to, whether it's, you know, against lefties or against righties. That changeup made a lot of strides too. He doesn't use it as much, but I think that has a chance to be plus, even though it's not the same, not the ideal separation off his fastball, but I think it can be a really, really effective pitch. So he has the stuff to miss a ton of bats. I think his command needs to improve. They've kind of mixed him between starting and relieving. I think just getting him into their, just to get him onto the field for their major league club, their rotation is obviously really, really strong in Milwaukee, but I see him as a starter long-term. I don't know if it's going to come right away or if they just kind of ease him in to that through a bullpen role starting out, like kind of like they did with Burns and Woodruff too. But I think he has a chance to be a number two type starter potentially, and just stacking him up compared to some of the other top left-handed pitching prospects in the game. I like guys like Reed Detmers and Liberatore, and, you know, DL Hall obviously has great stuff, but I think you make a case he's the best left-handed pitching prospect in the game right now.
Yeah, I think that would be a strong one. And I actually wanted to touch on another left-handed pitching prospect. I don't know where you would include him in this conversation, but my guy that I was kind of just more impressed than I expected to be is Nick Lodolo, the left-handed pitcher with the Reds. I don't know if it's just kind of lingering comments about the 2019 pitching class. That class was one of the worst college pitching classes that we'd seen, and Nick was just the top pitcher in that class. So I think I just associate the perceived weakness of that group with Nick, and maybe that's unfair for me to do so. But I mean, he's been really impressive, and two other players in that class have probably made it look a little bit better than scouts were talking about it at the time, just between Alek Manoah, what he's done, and then the pitcher that George Kirby has developed into. But what has impressed me with Lodolo is just the strikeout rate that he's maintained. Especially at the upper levels of the minors. And in 2021, he struck out almost 14 per nine at the AA level, where the bulk of his season came. That was 10 starts and 44 innings, and he posted a 1.84 ERA with fewer than two walks per nine. The two walks per nine is not surprising to me. He was always a really polished pitcher who seemed to have a good feel for filling up the zone, using a fastball slider changeup combination. But I was always just a little bit concerned about whether or not he would get enough swing and miss to kind of get the ceiling that you would want from a top 10 in a class college pitcher. And to this point, he has done better than I expected in that regard. Maybe the slider, which was always a good pitch, is just a legitimate plus pitch for him. And then when you combine the fastball command, his ability to go in and out, his confidence in using a changeup, and using a few other pitches that are maybe a little bit fringier, because I don't think that anything in his arsenal is as loud as Aaron Ashby's. But when you pair his ability to repeat his delivery, repeat his release point, spot up in the zone, and really attack wherever he wants, I think it helps a lot of that stuff play up, or at least it seems to be the case so far. So that's a guy who I think I would say entering the prospect handbook season, I probably had a less exciting opinion of him just when I thought about him. And now it's certainly elevated just looking at the numbers he's produced and how good he's continued to be. Again, it's not a huge bulk of innings. He's still only thrown 69 innings in the minors, but he's continued to be the pitcher that I thought he could be, or I thought he was from a pitchability standpoint in college, and the whiffs have still been there. So that's an encouraging one for me.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good delivery. He repeats it, fills the zone, a ton of strikes. It's going to be, you know, plus, if not plus plus control. And the stuff is, I mean, yeah, it's not Ashby stuff. I think it's still pretty good. Like, I don't know, there's like a wipeout 70 pitch that he's ever going to have in there, but it's pretty good velocity still from the left side. You talked about the slider. I think it's an effective changeup. So it's something where everything plays up to just because of his ability to mix and match and hit his spots too.
Two other players that I wanted to mention really quick, just from doing the Braves chapter. I mean, Michael Harris, I specifically wanted to just mention his defensive ability. I saw some like advanced data that would suggest that he was one of the better defensive outfielders in the minors. I don't know how much stock to put in those numbers at this point, just because my familiarity with that is pretty early on. But the scouts that I talked to as well just raved about his defense. And he was a lot closer to how scouts talked about Christian Pache than I ever expected to hear from Michael Harris. So when you combine that with his bat to ball ability, with his tool set overall, he's obviously a guy who jumped from outside of the top 10 to number one. So it wasn't as surprising to me to feel really confident about him. And then Zach Veen was another. He was obviously a top 10 player in his draft class, one of the better hitters in the high school class. You could argue he was the best hitter. I think we had him as the highest ranked hitter in that class. But his performance just gave me a little bit more optimism about his hitting ability. It's still lower levels, but I thought he might strike out a little bit. I think he hit over 300, 400, 500, ran really well. Again, I thought he was going to be a little bit slower just in terms of like the stolen bases he would give you. And again, part of this might just be the different rule set that we're working with in the lower minors that
right.
makes you a little bit more skeptical about stolen base totals. But I mean, Veen did everything that I would imagine you want him to do given a player of his pedigree. And I think with his frame, with his raw power, we're only going to see more and more power output with him. So even if those stolen base numbers back up, which I expect they will, I think that he's still a player that's going to give you average, going to give you on base, going to give you slug. And he's athletic enough to play a pretty good corner. So he's a guy who I don't know if this is me appreciating him more, but just kind of him producing and kind of confirming the player that we thought he could be when he was showing flashes during his spring season in high school, when he was kind of shooting up draft boards. So those are two more. I don't know if you had any others, Ben.
No, he's a good one. I mean, it's, you know, there is still some swing and miss to it that he showed, but within that, I think maybe hope almost to some extent, it should be manageable for him. And there's a really broad base of other skills that he has too, between the athleticism, the power. He's patient. He's not just up there as a free swinger. I think there's going to be some strikeouts, but he's going to hit for, I think, a lot of power.
Yeah.
And he's patient. He's going to draw some walks.
The 13% offset. The 13% walk rate is really encouraging, and it really shouldn't be surprising to me. Just watching him in high school, he always seemed like a player who had a pretty keen understanding of the strike zone. And while he did swing and miss in high school, I never really saw him expand the zone much. It wasn't to the same level as like Corbin Carroll zone awareness, but it was pretty good. It would be up there with some of the best like zone awareness and swing decisions in terms of in zone versus out of zone that I can remember off the top of my head now. So that makes me feel confident about, like you're saying, even if there is some swing and miss, that OBP and that power should give you a pretty safe floor, I would imagine.
Yeah, a lot of really strong reports on him too from scouts who really were following him closely last year.
Kind of jumping off this conversation, Ben, with how we've seen Ashby's velocity and development tick up with the Brewers, how does a player's organization, the org that they're with, that organization's track record of developing players or their track record of not having players pan out, how does that affect how you look at a player? Does it at all? How do you factor that into rankings? And just how do you think about that generally?
Yeah, I try just to rank the player and evaluate the player independent of the organization. You know, the Brewers, I don't think they will, but like they could say, hey, we have plenty of pitching. We're going to trade Aaron Ashby tomorrow to another organization. And so that could happen at any time. But it's hard not to, look at the success that the Brewers have had in developing pitchers like Woodruff and Burns. And, they didn't sign Freddie Peralta, but they got him when he was at the lower levels of the minor leagues and really did develop him, Devin Williams too. So there's a pretty strong track record there in Milwaukee that probably does give me more belief and more confidence in Ashby. But I try not to let that influence the report or the projection or the ranking on him. But on the other hand, it's, like a lot of the we're having conversations with a lot of different scouts and front office people throughout the game. And, had known a lot of these, these folks, going back 10, 15 years in some cases. So, if you're having a conversation with somebody who you think has a really good track record of evaluating pitchers, let's say, for example, and has been historically correct on a lot of them. If not publicly, then at least in conversations, with you privately, just for these calls on players, I'm more apt to give that evaluators more weight sometimes if they have that track record. I think they really have a good eye for what they're looking at. So something like that, if I'm talking to a scout or a front office official, somebody in player development who I think really knows and has a good eye for and track record with me for what they're doing and what they're looking at, that is something that it probably will more heavily influence the way that I might write up or view a player.
I'm looking forward to your top evaluator rankings dropping at some point this year, Ben. No, that's a good call. You definitely have to get a feel for just biases that people have, or like you said, just the hit rate that you have with the evaluators you talk with. And it's something that you've probably been developing for decades now. You've been in here for 2 decades, right?
Started in 2007. So
you're
coming up on 15 years. But
okay.
I think if you're a scouting director too, you have to do the same thing with your, with your area scouts and your cross checkers too. Like you probably have certain guys who you really trust on, breaking down a hitter, or just knowing your own scouts and how they tend to lean and how they tend to evaluate. Cause some guys are, a little bit more, sunny and optimistic on players. And then you have other scouts that I'm sure you've talked to too, who will just like crush everybody.
Everyone. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. A 50 for, I guess a 40 for one scout is not the same as a 40 for another.
Yeah. Everybody, views things through a different lens. So if you're running if you're running a draft, or if you're an international director, or if you're a GM too, and you're trying to, understand where your, where your reports are coming from, trying to make a decision on a trade, just knowing, knowing your own staff, your own evaluators is important. And it's obviously a different situation for us, but there's a lot of similarities too, just in terms of knowing, having a track record and having history with the people you speak with. So, if this guy gets like really excited about a player, it means something.
Yeah.
Because he is usually pretty brutally canted on guys.
I think that way about Josh sometimes. He's such a skeptic in general and hates players. So when he's excited about one guy, I kind of do a double take and make sure I'm paying attention to who he likes. But no, that's a good point. Kind of going back to Ashby a little bit, Ben, what jumped out to me when reading his report, and you guys, if you want to read Ben's full report on Ashby and the rest of the Brewers, check that out at the website, was just the velocity uptick over the course of, I don't know how many years it's been, three or four years, or maybe even 4 or 5 years at this point. But he used to be a guy who was pitching in the mid 80s, and now he's touching 99 miles per hour from the left side. So how are you viewing just velocity gains from pitchers? It seems like it's just become so common for teams to get pitchers in their systems now, improve their velocity, whether that's just a better understanding kind of universally of how to add velocity, how to take care of your body, how to train your arm. How do you view that? And how do you view pitchers who have below average velocity? Do you kind of just assume they're going to make gains? How do you view just the velocity question? Because for me, it seems like more and more teams just know how to unlock that. How are you viewing it? And how does Ashby's velocity growth over the years change or affect how you think about pitching?
Yeah, it's with Ashby, it's been this like, I mean, he's had some jumps. I don't know if I'd call them spikes, but it's been sort of a steadier progress with him. It's not like he came out 1 year and all of a sudden added, you know, 4 to 5 miles an hour on his fastball. So it's just been sort of in this upward trend pointing in the right direction, both with, well, his velocity and just his slider too, I think keeps taking steps forward. But I think that in addition to, you know, just obviously the health is such a big factor, but it's what makes projecting pitching so difficult, right? Like I think certainly like the younger you go, the more, you know, leniency you have on, all right, well, certainly this, you know, 17-year-old you're signing out of the Dominican Republic who's got a fast arm, is up to 93 and is about, you know, 6'2", 165 with like a good delivery. All right, you can expect him to add velocity just through natural strength progression, extra calories getting into his system. So there, you know, you can, there are certain projection indicators where you can not necessarily count on that happening, but where you can make a good bet that velocity increase will come for a player. But yeah, now we just see more guys even coming out of college, you know, George Kirby, you know, bumping up their velocity. You know, it's like Jacob DeGrom is like the prime example of just how dramatically a pitcher, you know, can change from when he was in college or the lower levels of the minor leagues. Like you go back and read his scouting reports when he was in the early days in the Mets system, and it just, like, there's nothing in there that looks like the Jacob DeGrom that we see today. So it definitely makes it, you know, more challenging as we're seeing, you know, amateur, like college age players and players in the lower levels or even upper levels of the minor leagues sometimes who are in their 20s making these velocity jumps that we probably didn't see as much going back, you know, 5-10 years ago.
Yeah, are there any other notable players that are made velo jumps since getting in an org that kind of come to mind outside of Ashby?
Yeah, I mean,
I think Kyle Harrison is one a few years ago, mm-hmm. or I think it was maybe just last year. He made a pretty significant uptick in velocity and already had a good foundation of pitchability and strike throwing that makes that really exciting.
Yeah, I think the most interesting one this year is Ricky Tiedemann from the Blue Jays, left-handed pitcher, another JUCO guy like Ashby. So he's younger. He was, you know, JUCO guy drafted at what he would have been 19, 18 during the draft, or he was young still.
He was very young for the draft initially out of high school. And so then going to JUCO and getting drafted out of college, he was exceedingly young for just college players in general, but yeah, always young for his
right. Life. So, you know, playing out JUCO ball in California, and, you know, reports on him out there were like up to 93 or 94, you know, a little bit up from what he had shown before, but, you know, pretty consistently 88, 93, 94. Gets drafted third round pick by the Blue Jays in 2021, doesn't pitch during, you know, the season. They just, you know, wanted to manage his workload coming out of there. And he goes to instructional league, and I don't think he threw a pitch under 94 at instructions, what he had topped out at earlier in the year. And he was up to 98. So we're talking about within, you know, from the time he was drafted to instructional league right after the minor league season, a jump of 4 miles an hour in top end velocity. So, you know, we have instead of a lefty who, you know, had a lot of things to like between, you know, a decent fastball, but a really athletic pitcher with a plus changeup at times. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that not kind of blow you away stuff. Now, all of a sudden, it's a lefty up to 98 with, mm-hmm. you know, flashing a plus changeup. So,
yeah, the athleticism for him in high school and just the body, you could see that it was a body that he could fill out and get really strong. I don't know what his height and weight was listed at in high school, but I think now he's like 6'4", 220, really strong, broad shoulders, just looks like a physical beast on the mound at this point.
Yeah, and it's hard to know again, like, I mean, a little different situation than Ashby was just because the circumstances of 2020, but, you know, it's hard to know just how much stock it's real. Like, he was throwing 94 to 98 at instructs, but just how much does that change his future outlook? Mm-hmm. Right. Like, and it was, you know, obviously it's coming in shorter stints there at instructs, but you know, curious to see like what he'll be sitting at next year. And then sometimes when these guys have a, you know, a fast velocity spike like that, sometimes it's like I almost get a little nervous, like is he doing something different mechanically that's putting more stress on his elbow or on his arm to generate that velocity? Is it going to, you know, increase his injury risk? I mean, certainly hope not, but it's, you know, there is a relationship obviously between velocity and injuries. So it's just another factor.
Another pitcher in the Blue Jays system was Gunnar Hoglund, started throwing a lot harder and then got injured. I don't know if that's a direct correlation there, but to your point, when you start throwing harder, there are some reasons. It's not always just 100% a good thing. It's a good point.
Yeah, his stock is definitely up, right? Like, mm-hmm. I'd rather have Ricky Tiedemann who throws up to 98 than Ricky Tiedemann who throws
sure.
up to 94. So, but yeah, he's one guy where it's like, man, I don't quite know, especially in that Blue Jays system where it's like, yeah, you have kind of an obvious top, I think, five, we debate the order exactly, but like five, you know, six or so guys in there. And then after that, I think the system drops off, you know, pretty good. And you can debate the order after that. So I wasn't quite sure how high to run him. So he might end up being one of the most, even though he is in their top 10 prospects, he's somebody who I could see looking back a year from now and saying, oh, this guy was underrated coming into the year.
Appreciate that insight, Ben. I think those are all the topics we wanted to touch on today. Unless I'm missing something, is there anything else you want to just mention or throw out there before we kind of wrap things up, Ben? It's been great to get back on the podcast with you. And again, I've said this a few times, but I'm excited to get a consistent podcasting schedule and come to you guys regularly, because I am a little bit tired of having to not be able to answer why aren't we podcasting. And now that Ben's got his announcement out of the way, I can just put it all on you.
It's we didn't get a chance to just thank people, I guess, at the end of the year. like we normally would have. So yeah, just appreciate all you guys for listening and downloading and sticking with us. So like Carla said, we'll be back on a more regular schedule going forward. I mean, kind of a good thing for us. Obviously I don't want the lockout to continue, right? But like for a lot of what we do at Baseball America, like high school, like the draft, the college baseball, like scouting high school players, international signings, like the minor league player, like all pretty much most of that is going to go on as businesses as usual. So we got plenty to talk about.
Yeah, we absolutely do. We'll continue taking questions from you guys as we go throughout the week. So definitely reach out to us on Twitter. Mine is Carlos A. Collazo. Ben is at Ben Badler. And again, if you guys haven't left a review and you want to, you can do that at iTunes. Thank you to everyone who has already left a review and rated the podcast. Like Ben said, thank you guys so much for listening and downloading. This is, again, one of our more exciting projects we get to do here at BA. We really like doing the podcast and excited to bring it into its second year of existence in 2022. And like Ben said, as long as the lockout's here, we will still be producing content. We've got international content that's already on the site, more of that to come in the future. We've got our first combined draft list for the 2022 class coming soon. We've got some fantasy content that me and Ben and a few others on the staff have been working on lately. It's January at Baseball America, which is always a busy month. So if you are gearing up for the season, whether that's high school, whether that's college, whether that's the minors, there should be something for you there. So again, thank you to everyone for listening. For Ben, I'm Carlos. Until next time, everybody.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.